Now let me recapitulate what we have done to this point. What we've tried to do in the course to this point is to pose certain basic questions about the meaning of history, and we've tried to see what kind of answers have been offered within the human situation to these problems. We've seen how cyclical interpretations of history have been presented. We've seen how linear views of history have derived from the Christian view but have not had support for them. We pointed out last time that if a person is not convinced that the Christian view of history or the biblical view of history offers a sufficient grounding for the meaning of human events, then he is led along certain paths. He is led either to provide a secular interpretation of the linear Christian view. The trouble with this is that he doesn't have the perspective to see where the line moves. Nobody has this kind of perspective within the human drama, because everybody is bound into the human drama and is therefore limited. Another alternative is to move back into the Greek cyclical view of history. The problem with this is that it never finally answers anything. And it is based upon the assumption, which cannot be defended, that the products of human action necessarily suffer in the very same way as the individual human beings who partake of the action. Toynbee emphasized this in the film we saw last time, that merely because individual human beings pass through cycles in their lives doesn't mean that those cycles have to be superimposed on the history that they create. Then there's a third alternative, and that's the alternative of historiographical despair. History doesn't mean anything. Or history means as many things as the existential experience of the individual indicates. This produces a nihilism in the interpretation of history. It becomes impossible for history to have any meaning beyond the individual interpretation of it. Such a view has appeared again and again in the history of thought, and it is especially evident when the cyclical or secular linear views collapse. When people discover the difficulties with those, then they tend to drop into despair. But human beings still ask the question, where is history going? They cannot be satisfied with a total pluralism or a total nihilism in historical interpretation. The question keeps bugging people, and it keeps bugging the human race as to the meaning of events. And obviously there is some objectivity in the meaning of events. Otherwise, the history books wouldn't have as much in common as they do. What we've arrived at is this, that a secular perspective is just not going to do when it comes to the meaning of history. And logically, there are reasons for this. We pointed out when we were discussing Hegel that Hegel couldn't possibly get the perspective necessary to see that the human drama would issue out in the goal of freedom. When we were talking about Marx, we emphasized that Marx was in no position to see that a classless society would have to arise by necessity. The secularist has two strikes against him, apparently, and three strikes in fact, when he begins analyzing the meaning of history anyway, because he stands here in history, and his perspective is a limited perspective. He cannot get a total view of the entire expanse of history. Recent work in analytical philosophy of history has indicated this very clearly. For example, there is the book of Danto, who was a professor at Columbia. This work is entitled An Analytical Philosophy of History. It's published by Cambridge University Press. And Danto there tries to determine what the conditions would have to be for a valid interpretation of total history anyway. How could you, even in principle, arrive at such an interpretation? Says Danto, in order to get an interpretation of an event in the final sense, you'd have to see it in terms of its ultimate results. You'd have to see the present in light of the future, because it's quite clear that when we look at historical events, the interpretation of them alters according to the perspective we have on them. If we stand very close to them, we don't see them as clearly as when we stand farther away. So, it would be necessary, says Danto, to have the present viewed in light of the future in order to be able to comprehend it. But, of course, that would involve prophecy. Says Danto, the only genuine philosophy of history that could ever take place would be of the nature, unto you a Savior is born. Now, the reason that he uses this phrase is as follows. When Simeon and Elizabeth hold the baby, Jesus, they have contact only with a baby. I mean, visibly, this is only a baby. And when a statement is made, unto you a Savior is born, this is looking at this baby in terms of his growing up, his dying as a sacrifice for the sins of the world. In other words, that statement is a prophetic statement having to do with this baby as he's going to be later, or as he is potentially now, but you can't see the results of this potentiality. Says Danto, the only genuine philosophy of history would have to be able to say things of that kind in regard to events. But obviously, says Danto, nobody can say this. Nobody has that kind of perspective. So, says he, in principle, there cannot be philosophy of history. There cannot be philosophy of history in any general sense of the term. There can be the limited interpretation of historical events and wider interpretations of historical events, but never can interpretations be set at the widest limit. Logically, they can't be. I think Danto is quite right. Unless a word were to come in from outside the human situation, indicating the significance of the events along this line, a word from somebody who could see the whole business, and who in fact was responsible for the whole business, an interpretation of any event along this timeline would not have any necessitarian quality about it. Now what this says is that logically, either there is a word coming in from the outside, or the discipline of philosophy of history is actually unable to fulfill itself. If we had the time to do it, I think I could show you the same thing about ethics. That ethics along this timeline is inevitably relativistic, even though human beings recognize the necessity of a non-relative ethic that applies to situations whether they change or not situationally. Again, a word is needed to come in from the outside. Otherwise, the poor Negro may be equal to the white man in one culture, but deserve to be his lackey in another. And by the same token, one interpretation of history, which conflicts with another, remain on the same level without any arbitration. What all of this does, then, is to throw us necessarily, not just because of chance failures on the part of secular philosophy of history, into the realm of theology of history. We find ourselves thinking theologically about history because the only way you could interpret the whole is by way of a Savior being born, if you will, being able to see the present in light of the future. It isn't until next week and the two following weeks that we get into the specific evidence that this is exactly what has happened. But tonight, I want to present you a couple of examples of theological interpretations of history that are very striking and that can whet your appetite for the kind of theology of history that we're going to be talking about in the final sessions. I want you to see how a couple of interpretations of history that are grounded theologically are able to penetrate so much deeper into the meaning of the human drama than non-theological interpretations. We're not considering tonight whether the grounding of these interpretations is the case or not. We're not going to consider whether the word has indeed entered the human situation. We're simply going to see what a couple of theologians do with the interpretation of history, and I think that this will encourage you to move from philosophy of history into theology of history as you deal with the kind of questions that we've talked about in the course. Now, the two theologians that we're going to discuss this evening, one of them is actually not a professional theologian at all, but his interpretation of history is a theological one. The two people we're going to talk about tonight are Anders Nygren, a Swede, of course. And if you want to be terribly technical, it's Nygren, but we're not going to be terribly technical. He is the Bishop of Lund in Sweden, and formerly taught theology at the University of Lund. He had the great misfortune of being chosen bishop, and that has meant the end of a good theological career for many people in Scandinavia. About the worst thing that can happen to a person there is to become a bishop, because then he is loaded down with administrative responsibilities and cannot continue theologically. On the other hand, it's such a great honor, and it has so much significance in the church life of Scandinavia that the person can't resist. So this is what has happened to Nygren, and the book that we're going to be talking about tonight, which presents a theological interpretation of history, is a work which he wrote a number of years ago, and which was translated first into German, and then partially into English, and finally in a complete English translation. The other theologian of history is Erik Veglen. Now, Erik Veglen may well be known to you as a political scientist. He is German, but an expatriate. He is now in the United States and is teaching in Louisiana, of all places. His work has concentrated in political science. He is the author of several works in this area, which are known to people who operate in that field. But the work that we are especially concerned with is a six-volume production dealing with the meaning of history entitled Order and History. This is a series of which there are four volumes out and two volumes to come. And the work of Anders Nygren is entitled Agape and Eros. This should be Order in History. Now, I should say at the outset that I'm not placing a kind of imprimatur on the total theology of these people. And you shouldn't get the idea that because we're discussing them in terms of philosophy of history, we're saying that anything that they happen to say on any theological subject is necessarily going to be correct. It probably shouldn't be necessary to say this. Everyone has the right to quote and cite and discuss people without putting a mark upon their forehead indicating that everything they say is ideal. We will not be getting into the details of the theology of these people. What we want to do is to talk about the way in which they have understood history. They are both understanding history from a theological perspective. Let's begin with Nygren. Nygren's book is entitled Agape and Eros. Now, that's not the kind of title that would cause people to trample each other to buy the book at the friendly neighborhood bookseller, by any means. And it's necessary to know what these terms mean, because the interpretation of history presented by Nygren is bound up with the meaning of these two Greek words. They are Greek words, and both of them are words meaning in English love. However, the word love is a terribly ambiguous expression. It's used for all kinds of things, and it covers, not only a multitude of sins, but also a multitude of interesting linguistic usages. In the Greek language, the term love is expressed by three different words. These are all mixed together in our use of the English word love. The two most strongly contrasting meanings of the word love in the Greek language are eros and agape. Eros is the expression which is used in classical Greek philosophy for love. And it has to do with a person loving someone better than himself or having more advantages than himself in order to receive a benefit. Eros strives upward in order to get something for itself. In Platonic philosophy, people endeavor to move upward to the realm of the good and the true and the beautiful, either by intellectual effort or by mystical experience or by a combination of both. And in doing this, they attain benefits for themselves. An upward arrow is the mark of Eros. From man to the divine. In Aristotle's philosophy, a person loves that which is higher in order to get benefit, and all beings are ranged in what Lovejoy has called in modern times the great chain of being, until finally, when you reach the pinnacle, you arrive at God. Now, since God doesn't have anybody higher to love, he loves himself. And he spends eternity loving himself, and he is totally unaware of anyone farther down on the chain of being. Because naturally, if he were aware of anybody farther down, that would be dissatisfying to him. He would gain nothing from it. So his eternity is spent cosmically in a kind of narcissism. You might consider it a sort of cosmic homosexuality. Though Aristotle would not have been terribly happy with that kind of a designation for it. On the other hand, you know, in the Platonic school, homosexuality was normative. Though this is not mentioned very frequently in elementary philosophy courses. Value placed upon homosexuality is in part connected with the Eros idea of love, because one loves not to give but to get. And of course, in a homosexual relationship, the chances are very slim of getting a baby, for example. Now, in contrast to the Eros relationship, the Greek language has a term, agape, which was a very weak term until the New Testament. It had very little force, and it was taken over by the biblical writers and filled with content. They needed a term which was not already firmly comprehended in terms of a static content to express the new idea of love which is present in biblical revelation. The idea of agape is exactly the opposite of eros. It is loving not for the sake of getting something, but for the sake of giving to someone in need. It's symbolized by the arrow coming down. In the biblical revelation, God is agape. God expresses himself in the kind of love that moves down to those in need. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Such a concept is utterly foreign to the Greek experience. For Aristotle's God to come down would be a denial of his own nature. But for the Christian God to come down and touch people in need is directly part of his nature. And when this agape love reaches the human situation, it splatters out into it. when a person experiences this kind of love in his own life, when he sees that God was willing to give himself for the person, even though the person didn't deserve this in any sense of the word, the result is that he finds that he must do this in relation to his fellows. The central principle of the biblical ethic is we love because he first loved us. That kind of love is endemic. It's catching. It can't remain within the person who has received it. Now, in Agape and Eros, Nigrin isolates these two concepts of love, and he points out that these have become basic motifs in Western history, and that they can be employed as means of explaining the civilizations that have existed in the West. Nigrin concentrates on the Greek experience, the Israelite experience, on the Middle Ages and the Renaissance and the Reformation. And he puts these together in terms of an Eros and Agape pattern. I have diagrammed this in my Shape of the Past, and I'll just put this diagram on the board very quickly so that you can see what's going on. In the Greek experience, Eros was predominant. In the biblical experience, Agape. Now, both of these streams came together in the greatest of the church fathers, St. Augustine. St. Augustine stood as a colossus between the ancient world and the Middle Ages. Augustine had been a Neoplatonist before he became a Christian, and he had absorbed something of Eros. When he became a Christian, Agape became predominant, but Augustine carried some Eros on into the Christian faith with him. And as a result of this, he created a mixture of these two, a mixture which for him was 99 and 44/100% Agape and a very small amount of Eros. But as the Middle Ages move on, as the period of the Middle Ages moves on, the Eros rises to the top and becomes more and more predominant. Why? Because self-centeredness and self-giving are like oil and water. You can't really mix them. One of them or the other has to come to the top. As Jesus said, no man can serve two masters. And as a result of the mixing together of these in the theology of the medieval church, by the time you reach the end of the Middle Ages, Eros and Agape are in an explosive tension. Some people, like the indulgent seller Tetzel, are telling people that by tossing a coin on a drum, it's possible for them to release their mother from purgatory into heavenly bliss. That by an act of this kind on man's part, it's possible to push a button and certain things will happen on the divine level. That man can control the situation through his own acts of love. On the other hand, people like Luther, in going back to the New Testament message, are convinced that it's not possible for man to do anything to save himself in that fashion, but rather salvation depends entirely on God coming down and meeting man in his need. Under those circumstances, at approximately the 16th century, there is a fragmentation of this synthesis of Agape and Eros in the Middle Ages, and Eros flies off again in the High Renaissance. While Agape is expressed again in much the New Testament way in the Reformation. We might take a look at this synthesis for a minute. This synthesis Nigrin calls the caritas synthesis, from the medieval Latin word for love. This medieval Latin word is the source of our word charity. And it appears in the King James and Douay translations of 1 Corinthians 13, the love chapter. The greatest of these is charity. This word caritas, or our word charity, is a clear indication of how eros and agape got sloshed together in the Middle Ages. Think of the word charity for a moment. Now, if you can avoid thinking of sweet charity, and think of charity in a non-cinematographic sense, you will undoubtedly think of a Lady Bountiful image. Charity makes you think of Lady Bountiful, out there giving coins to the poor. Notice how agape and eros are blended together in this, and how eros has become predominant. As Lady Bountiful tosses coins to the multitude, the main benefit is not to the multitude, it's to Lady Bountiful. She feels just grand about this. This is an indication of just how charitable she is. By the end of the Middle Ages, caritas, that kind of piety, was predominant. And it was against that that the reformers attempted to set forth the biblical position on salvation by the free grace of God, not by what we do, but by what he already did for us. This is a striking kind of interpretation, and it's remarkable. If you work on Greek, biblical, medieval, Renaissance, Reformation history, how illuminating this interpretation of history is. When Jacob Burckhardt, in his work on the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy, hit on the individualism motif for the Renaissance, he hit on a principle on the basis of which he was able to do an amazing, striking interpretation of the Renaissance. There's probably never been a greater interpretation of the Renaissance than that of Burckhardt. It goes to extremes, it's been criticized, etc. But when Burckhardt caught the motif of individualism, he caught a motif which made it possible to unravel the Renaissance. But you see, that individualism is really a special case of eros. Why was it, as Burckhardt described it, that some of the signori in Italy would spend their time in the outdoor sport of rolling boulders from their castles down onto their own peasants working in the fields? Why did they play ten pins with their own peasants? Simply because it was great fun. They enjoyed it. They got something out of it. And it didn't make any difference what the peasant got, namely a very sore head if he were lucky. The individualism, you see, was a manifestation of eros, of self-centeredness, of gaining all you can for yourself, regardless of the other fellow. By the end of the Middle Ages, this unstable combination of eros and agape exploded. And that explosion provides us with the individualistic, self-centered Renaissance, which created great works of art, but which was more interested in feathering its own aesthetic nest than it was in the needs of others. And on the other hand, the Reformation, where people endeavored to reestablish the gospel of the free grace of God. All right, let me pass on now, quickly, to Erich Weigelin. When I wrote The Shape of the Past several years ago, only a few volumes of Weigelin's Order and History had come out. Now, more volumes are out, and realizing that Weigelin would be completing this work, I did not diagram his philosophy of history in the book. I intended to wait until the completion of Weigelin's work, and I'm still intending to do a revision of that section of The Shape of the Past as soon as the work is completed, as soon as Weigelin completes it. However, I will give you on the board a diagram expressing Weigelin's philosophy of history. This is the diagram which in all probability will appear in subsequent editions of The Shape of the Past, but it is not yet for publication because it might just be that in the last volume Weigelin would reverse gears or do something that would require some sort of alteration in this. So what I've done in The Shape of the Past is to describe his view in general terms, but I haven't schematized it. Now I want to schematize it for you, And I think that this will be especially useful because the schema is very similar in certain respects to the scheme as we have it on the board for Nigra. I'll do it over, where will I do it? Can I erase that now? Is that legal? Okay, I got it. So we have Nigra here. And now, Bagley. Now, Bagley's position is a good deal more difficult than Nigrin's, because if you think that agathe and eros constitute agonizing technical terms, then when you come to Bagley, you find technical terms that are even more sticky. Nonetheless, as in all fields, the technical terms are useful because they cut down on the amount of sheer palaver once you understand them, and so we are going to deal with these terms. In the first place, there is the negative expression in Bagley's system. The bad guys, if you will, those are the black hats. And the term used to cover them, or it, is metastatic gnosis. Wild. The positive term, this is the negative term here, the positive term is true order. True order. And this is the expression that appears in the title of the series. Bagley is interested in contrasting true order in history with false order, with specious order. And the specious order, or false order, is the metastatic gnosis. Why does he use the term metastatic gnosis? Not simply to make life difficult for people who read his system, but because these terms have definite significance. First of all, take gnosis. Now, in the early church, there were heretics known as Gnostics. This expression comes from the Greek word meaning to have intellectual knowledge of something. Not necessarily experiential knowledge, but noggin knowledge. Knowledge in the head, maybe no more than that. The Gnostics were people who felt that they had a special pipeline to God. They really knew the way things were, whereas others didn't. They had a secret tradition, a special knowledge that other people didn't. On the basis of this, they were convinced that they had the answers and other people didn't. These Gnostics fell into various ancient heresies. For example, Manichaeism, they felt that the body was essentially evil and the spirit would have to go flip-flap off away from it in order to be pure, and all kinds of things like this. We can't go into details, but the point is that Gnosticism is a false conviction that you know the way, you know the score, when in fact you don't. What about metastatic or metastasis? Well, this comes from two Greek words, meta and stasis. Stasis is a condition, a stable condition. Meta is a prefix having to do with change or alteration in. Metastatic gnosis, or let's take metastasis alone. Metastasis is an inversion of the situation as it really is. Turning things inside out, upside down. Making things wrong-headed. Well, you put them together, and they don't spell mother. They spell a firm conviction that one has the truth, but in point of fact, this has come about through reversing things, turning them upside down, looking at them from the wrong end. Bagley is convinced that through human history, there has been an interplay of these two concepts, and he goes into great detail as to how this operates. There is one other term that is necessary for Bagley's system, and it's leap in being. Now, a leap in being is a change from metastatic gnosis to true order. In other words, if people come to their senses, in the full sense of the word,
then at that point a leap in being occurs. If you happen to be theologically inclined, I can translate these terms for you into traditional theological terminology. Leap in being equals revelation and the effect that it has. Metastatic gnosis is sin. And true order is redemption. Redemption viewed in terms of process, of the process, and the kingdom of God, if you will, or God's rule or reign in the larger sense. Vagan also begins with the Greeks and with the Hebrews. Here the diagram becomes a little more complex, and here we're going to use a dotted line to represent metastatic gnosis, and a solid line to represent true order, and we're going to use the dot to represent leap in being on the diagram. Now, as in the diagram over here, this arm represents, we'll say, the classical world. So for all practical purposes, embracing what Nigren talks about as the Greek experience, but of course also including the Roman period as well. Down here, we have the biblical worldview, or maybe it would be better to say the ancient Near East, which corresponds roughly to the biblical picture as Nigren talks about it. For Vagelin, in both of these segments of the human drama, things begin in metastatic gnosis, and there is a leap in being which introduces true order. Now, of course, the metastatic gnosis continues underground, if you will, and never completely disappears. And for Vagelin, it surfaces and becomes predominant in the 18th century. And modern history is really a playing of different melodies on the theme of metastatic gnosis. So that when we reach our own time, we have two varieties of metastatic gnosis, as represented by the Marxist East and by the capitalist West. The section from here to here represents the Middle Ages and the Reformation. Roughly. Now let's talk about the, let's begin with the ancient Near East, actually. In the ancient Near East, most of the nations were organized theocratically, that is, the pharaoh or whatever the political leader was considered to be a theophany, a divine being, and his presence made things truly divine.